is pretty close to what you're what you've
good. I wasn't sure when to plug it up, plug my comments in. So good. Thank you, Rip. Okay.
Thank you for the segue, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. One, all members and staff are reminded that you've gotten an electronic version of a Office of Inspector General survey. It needs to be completed by Friday, June 22nd. That's the deadline. All the councils, all eight of the councils and their staffs have been given the same survey. There's under tab one, there are comments that we provided on National Standard 1 Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. Those comments are due by August 1st. I found out yesterday that we were the only council to submit comments. We submitted them last week, and all the other councils are going to send a letter to the service asking for an extension under the council chairman's letterhead. So we'll have another bite at it. If you look at our comments and want to add some, they're in the binder. If you want to add some additional comments, just get them to me, and we can add them as part of the chairman's letter. Under tab six, under tab one, number six, you'll see some changes to some policy that were discussed at executive committee, and I'd like to go through those and ask the chair that, you know, we actually, if we don't have any objection, that we go ahead and approve these so we can change the SOPs. The first one is on authority of the chairman. In Robert's rules, chairman are allowed to be voting members of every committee as an ex officio member. They can vote, they can be part of every committee, and we've always had that. We've never had it in the SOPs at all. It's been in Robert's rules, so this just cements the fact that our chairman now is ex officio on every committee committee and will vote when he sees fit as an ex officio member. And Robert's rule says he will not be counted as a majority, included in the majority vote. So if you've got six members, you still need a majority outside of the chairman. He's not counted towards that. So that's one policy that we're clarifying under the SOPs. The second one is public testimony. Under our policy, you'll see that we have a whole, section on when the public come to the microphone. We've decided to delete all that and just simply have a sheet at the table that basically says, for the record, please state your name, the organization you represent, if any, and the number of members who belong to your organization. So that will replace all that information and is at the table for the public now. The third change asking for you to approve is concerning advisory panels, just what Jeff just talked about. We've got AP chairs may leave the committee table and comment from the public microphone when providing personal comments or speaking on behalf of those they represent. So, in other words, when you're at the table, you're part of the council process in terms of part of the development of fishery management plans, and you'll represent the AP. And as best you can, represent the opinions as chair of the AP. If you have personal opinions and you have or business opinions, you should leave the table and make your comments accordingly. And that's what the executive committee agreed with. And the last change is under PDT. If you recall, at our last meeting, we passed a policy that that had a second look at PDT membership outside of academia and the states and federal government scientists, looking at industry-funded scientists and non-NGO scientists. And the council asked for some criteria. So the executive committee looked at four criteria for membership outside of our normal, process on a case-by-case basis and came up with knowledge and skills are commensurate with PDT tasks an ability to remain unbiased during PDT deliberations, the capacity to discuss, negotiate, and compromise if necessary with other PT members. In other words, how does that member fit in with the makeup of the PDT? And lastly, do they have a unique skill set? It's got to be unique, not just run-of-the-mill scientists. Is it something unique that the PDT needs, or a perspective that they need to do their job better? So those were the criteria. So those are the four changes, and if there's no objection, Mr. Chairman, we'll add them to the SOPs.
Mary Beth.
I don't have any objections, really just a question about number four, Paul. A unique skill set or perspective that does not currently exist, and I noticed that you listed the following four criteria shall be evaluated. So I'm assuming number four is not limiting, per se, because you may decide that, you know, you want two people who represent a certain, you know, skill set. Stock assessment scientists, for example. So it's just an evaluation
right.
criteria. It's not limiting.
Right.
Okay.
Are there, Dr. Weinberg?
On that number four, I was wondering if there was any discussion about conflict of interest. I know you mentioned that they should remain unbiased, but was there discussion of conflict of interest, which is a different issue?
Well, that was the whole, you mean conflict of interest like council members have, financial conflict of interest? The conflict of interest from a council standpoint is financial conflict of interest. And they apply only to council members and staff. When we deal with our science and statistical committees, they have financial interest as well that they have to divulge. But we didn't talk about financial disclosure for APs because it's not required in any of the Magnuson Act. But I mean, that's the point about having a industry-funded scientist or an NGO-funded scientist is to make sure that they leave their representation at the door and strictly concentrate on the science. That's what we talked about, but not financial interest. We didn't talk about that.
Anyone else? Let me ask, are there objections to including these in our SOPs? Dr. Pierce.
Not so much an objection, but I'm trying to compare what the executive committee has suggested for criteria for membership with the motion that we made at our last meeting, where I think I've got this right, that it carried 16-17, 0-0. So it was unanimous. The executive committee detailed considerations and criteria it will use when considering industry-funded and NGO-funded scientists and or staff of NGOs for PDT membership. The executive committee will bring the criteria back to full council for... Okay. No, it's covered. All right. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Without objection, we will update those SOPs. Anything else, Paul? Any other questions for Paul? Okay. We will move on to the regional administrator, Dan, or George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to give my usual report, followed by two short presentations by our staff. Travis Ford will give you a description of a proposed exempted fishery for skate bait. We have a requirement under the regulations to consult with the council before we make a final approval decision. So we'll have a brief presentation by Travis, and followed by a Mark Grant presentation on the proposed rule that the agency just published on confidentiality of data. So I'll go through my usual items first, and then we'll turn to those other two. The final rule for the 2012-2013 skate specifications were published on April 27th and became effective on May 1. We did approve the proposed ACL, ACT, and TALs for the fishery We did not, however, approve the proposed reductions in possession limits for the skate wing fishery. They had been proposed to be reduced to 2,200 pounds in season one and 3,600 pounds in season two. But we did not approve them because the fishery only landed 82% of its quota in 2011. So we felt that the reductions were not necessary to constrain the fishery and to spread it out. So the possession limit remains at 2,600 pounds. Under multi-species, on May 1st, we approved sector operations plans for 2012 and allocated the appropriate quotas for 14 groundfish stocks to each of those sectors, and granted sector vessels a number of exemptions. Currently, we have 18 sectors operating, 16 of which have active fishing vessels, and two that are private permit banks. Also, the New Hampshire and Maine state-operated permit banks were allocated quotas. For 2012, sectors and state-operated permit banks are allocated 99% of the groundfish quotas based on the landing's history of the 851 permits that are enrolled. Under Days at Sea and ACE summary reports, we have thus far in the fishing year through June 12th processed two common pool Days at Sea leases and 15 sector Days at Sea leases. Of those, both of the common pool leases were approved, and 14 of the 15 sector leases were approved. The total days at sea leased have been 27.9 for common pool and 410.62 for sectors, at an average cost per day at sea of $78.80 for common pool and $23.38 for sectors. Under sector ACE transfers, thus far, again through June 12th, we have processed 147 transfers of ACE, with a total pounds transferred of 2,498,734. Under scallops, on May 14th, we published in the Federal Register an emergency rule that was requested by the Council to close the Delmarva scallop access area for the remainder of the 2012 fishing year. The temporary rule became effective June 13th and reallocates 2012 full-time limited access scallop trips from Delmarva into the closed Area 1 access area. On May 9th, we published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register announcing a control date in the monkfish fishery, again at the request of the Council. That date, which is May 9th, the date of publication, 2012, may be used by the New England and Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Councils if they decide to limit accumulation of fishing privileges or develop sectors or IFQs or qualify individuals to vote in a referendum as part of a future management action. There is a public comment period on that, ANPR, and that closed on June 8th. The final rule for the 2012 spiny dogfish specifications was published on May 22nd, 2012, and becomes effective June 21st. We approved the recommendations of this council, both of the quota and the 3,000-pound status quo trip limit. And finally, under American lobsters, we published a final rule on June 1st to implement a limited entry program in the Area 1 lobster trap fishery, consistent with the recommendations of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission in Addendum 15 to Amendment 3 of the Commission's Interstate Fishery Management Plan for Lobster. That will prevent the migration of trap effort into federal waters of Area 1 by capping the number of federal Area 1 permits at recent levels. And that final rule is effective July 2nd. All current American lobster fishery permit holders will receive a letter within the next month with further instructions, and for people for whom we have already have proof of historic participation, we will tell them that in the letter. So that concludes this portion of my report, and I'll take questions if you'd like, and then we'll go to Travis's description of our proposed skate bait exemption.
Questions for the regional administrator. Travis, I think you're up.
Good morning. As George mentioned, we received a request from the industry for an exempted fishery for skate bait in southern New England. And so what we did is, this was back last spring, and we drafted an environmental assessment analyzing the request from industry. We also developed some other alternatives. After drafting the EA, we found that we had to change the months requested. They requested an exempted fishery from July.
Sure.
From a... From July through June through November, but we actually saw some trips that exceeded the 5% threshold for an exempted fishery. If a fishery catches more than 5% northeast multi-species, they're required to be part of the multi-species fishery. However, the skate bait fishery, it's a pretty clean fishery. They don't catch a lot of multi-species in southern New England. So we actually saw in the months of June and November, we saw a number of trips where they did exceed that 5% threshold. So we proposed a different alternative in the months of July through October to exempt the fishery from the requirements of the multi-species regulations. So we published a proposed rule back in May, and we received no comments on it. So we are required to consult with the council about it before it becomes final. If the rule is approved, this exempted fishery allows people to go out and target skate bait absent the requirements of the Northeast Multispecies Fishery. So, for instance, sector vessels will not be required to declare a sector trip, so you won't have the calculated discards attributed to these trips. Further, common pool vessels will not be required to use days at sea in order to target skate bait in this area during these months. And as George said, we're required to consult with the council on this before it goes final, and we're hoping to get this in place for July 1, which is when the exemption begins. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to field them.
Captain Nicola.
When they're on this trip, are they DOF? Are they coded in?
Yes. Yes, they're declared out of fishery.
Anyone else on the council? Rodney?
Yeah, that works fine. That works just right for the skate fishery because they don't even catch enough fish to eat at that period of time.
Yeah.
So that'll be good. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? George?
Just one follow-up. We have a similar request for another exempted fishery for spiny dogfish, which is earlier in the process. We're still analyzing that. There will be a proposed rule published, and at the appropriate time, we'll come back to the council for consultation on that one as well.
Go to the audience. Are there any comments? Back to the council. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
Is there a second presentation?
Yes. Okay.
Mark?
Good morning. Mark Grant, and I'm a sector policy analyst in the Northeast Regional Office. We recently published a proposed rule to update the regulations for confidentiality and how we handle data. As I'm not a lawyer and I'm not the author of the rule, this is just meant to be a quick summary presentation to alert you of what's in the proposed rule and also to let you know that the comment period has been extended through August 21st. So if you have questions that are detailed or comments you'd like to make, we do encourage you to submit comments through the process. So the goal in confidentiality and how we handle data is to balance the need to protect confidential information with exceptions that authorize disclosure of information to advance conservation and management, scientific research, enforcement and basically transparency in how we handle fisheries management. There are a number of other laws that also affect confidentiality in addition to the Magnuson Act, things like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Freedom of Information Act. The proposed rule I'm going to talk about today includes three types of proposed changes. The first is expanded scope of confidentiality requirements. The second is changes to some of the exceptions that allow disclosure. And the third is to make clarifications to the regulations. This isn't... Thanks. So first, there are a number of exceptions that allow us to disclose information that's otherwise confidential when it's submitted. The first one I want to talk about, and I've put the citations here. I realize nobody likes to deal with them, but it's the only way to really differentiate them, so they're just here as a reference. Some exceptions allow us to share information, provided the people receiving it keep it confidential. Other exceptions allow us to release information, even if confidentiality won't be maintained. And we also have the option to provide information in a summary or an aggregate information or an aggregate form that, you know, continues to maintain confidentiality. This particular exception allows the release of information that was required for determination under a limited access program. And so the rule proposes definitions for limited access program determination. They're on the slide. I'm not going to read through them. They're on your copies as a reference. I highlight this exception first. This is the one we use to release landings history to vessels during the development of Amendment 16. And the rule actually proposes a slightly different interpretation. And one of the key things is that the exception applies whether or not NMFS has actually made a determination under a limited access program, but if they are going to make one. So as an example, information that you submit to us that lets us determine whether you fished within an allocation is immediately releasable even before we make our final year-end determination as to whether that allocation was exceeded or met or under-harvested. But things like prior landing information could only be released to somebody other than the initial submitter after the council submitted an FMP or a framework or plan amendment to NMFS, and we published a Federal Register notice. So this would not allow us to release that information while the council is considering developing a limited access program. This is different than how we handled it in Amendment 16, and basically instead of being able to release to each permit holder the history of their permit during the development process, we would wait until after the council had submitted the plan. We also, for this particular exception in the rule, we propose to define the scope of the information that's releasable. And basically we propose that we would tailor information releases to the level of the determination being made. So, for instance, information submitted by a sector to determine whether or not they stayed within their ACE, we would only release at the sector level. But information submitted by an IFQ vessel submitted to determine whether it stayed within its individual quota could be released at the vessel level because that's the level of the determination we're making. Next one, please. Oh, yeah. Oh, good. Thanks. So briefly, there are a few more exceptions that do allow disclosure where the information might then go to the public or be available publicly and not maintained confidential. The first allows us to release information when it's required by a court order, but the rule proposes to clarify and define court and order so that it's clear it only applies to federal court orders and not to state court orders. Exemptions A and C allow us to release information to aid law enforcement activity. And the key thing there is that the information could become part of a public record and therefore would no longer be confidential. So we've proposed adding regulatory text that we can allow enforcement personnel to release the information during enforcement and clarify that that could then possibly become public. And exemption F allows the release of information in response to written authorization. I think most of you are familiar with this. If you want to get the landings history of a permit you're considering purchasing, the person who submitted that information has to give you written authorization to see that confidential information. So what we are proposing in the rule is to require the person submitting the request to make a statement under the penalty of perjury as to who they are and that they have the that they are the person with the right to release the information. And we also intend to develop and make available a form for authorizing the release of confidential information so that we get away from this process of every person trying to make sure they write the correct release information uniquely. A key thing that the rule highlights is that in the context of observer information, we handle the written authorization exception differently. For that, we propose to treat the permit holder, which is, you know, the vessel permit holder, as the submitter of the observer information that we collect for science and management purposes, lengths, weights, species, all of that information, but not as the submitter of information that's created for program administration. So things like the field notes, the journals, the forms filled out by the observer, that information other than the stuff that's used for science directly, the permit holder would not have the right to release because they're not the creator of that information. And then the third topic, as I mentioned, is the possibility to release information in a summary form or an aggregate form so that confidentiality is maintained but the information is usable for analysis, decision-making, management, etc. We limit releases to a form that doesn't disclose specified financial and operational information of a person. And so we're both proposing definitions for business of any person, and along with that, clarifying what financial information is and what operational information is. And then we also intend to develop, similar to the release, and make available for comment, aggregation guidelines based on the final definitions that are enacted. A really important point here in these definitions is that we're proposing to exclude specific observer information from the definition of business of any person. And it's limited to which information could be releasable, species of each marine mammal or Endangered Species Act listed species, date, time, and geographic location of the take, gear information that doesn't meet the definition of a trade secret. This would allow us to release observer information publicly in an aggregate or a summary form as long as it would not directly or indirectly result in the disclosure of the identity of the vessel involved. And the point of this is to advance the implementation of the statutory mandates under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. Finally, the rule also covers what we call limited disclosure or instances where we can release confidential information, but the recipient must maintain that confidentiality. So, for instance, council staff already, when they've signed the agreement, can receive confidential information and use it for analyses. And basically, we're updating and clarifying a number of those in this proposed rule. I'm not going to go into them in much detail, but we would allow, for instance, or we're adding the ability to release confidential information between observer programs for training or to validate observer data accuracy. We could release information for homeland and national security activities. We can release it to state employees that are responsible for fisheries management, to state employees that do FMP enforcement under a joint agreement with the federal government, to Marine Fisheries Commission employees, to council members for conservation and management. This is actually an update to what's currently in there to clarify that even when we can release it to council members, it doesn't allow them to publicly disclose it further. And there's also an update to allow the release to SSC members who aren't federal or state employees. Those would already be covered under existing releases, but now that it includes things like academicians, they don't have a specific release exception, so we clarify to cover that, and also for use when we're certifying observers. And with that, I guess I'll just leave it for some questions. Just to clarify, because it is an open comment period, I can't really answer questions about substance. I can try to answer basic things about what is in the rule and what isn't, but when it comes to interpretation, those are things that you'd have to actually ask for in a comment to have clarified.
Terry, then Mary Beth.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Mark, for the presentation. I'm sorry to have cut you short at the Groundfish Committee meeting. I appreciate the extension of the comment deadline, Dan and George. But I have one clarification question that perhaps you can't answer. Does this rule propose to release all data at the share level to the public?
You mean at the sector?
No, at the individual level.
Right now, it wouldn't, because we don't make an allocation at the individual vessel level, and we're not making a determination at that level in the world of sectors. As I said, if it was an IFQ where there's an individual quota that's being tracked and a determination is being made, vessel level information could be released.
Mary Beth.
Yeah, I was just looking for some clarification. In the very first part of your presentation, Mark, you were talking about the change from how you all had released information for permit holders under Amendment 16, in that people were seeking their history, and now it's going to be done differently. And I was not clear, because in another part it sounded like a permit holder can request the history of their vessel at any time. So maybe if you could just try to clarify that one.
Sure. Sorry for the confusion. So there is an exception that allows the release of confidential information when there's written authorization. And so, for instance, if I've owned a permit for 10 years and I want to release that 10-year history to somebody else, I can do that in writing. But let's say I bought the permit 5 years ago and I wanted to see the history from before I purchased it. I'd have to go find that owner and get a written release of that. The exception during Amendment 16 that we used was this 402B1G that said if you're making a determination under a limited access program, you could release it. So under that exception, I said, well, I know Mary Beth didn't own the permit for the full 11 years, but I'm going to use that 11-year period to make a determination about potential sector contribution for sectors. So I'm going to release her that 11-year history, even though she didn't submit all that information and doesn't have a written authorization. As it's proposed in this rule, we could still release that to you, but rather than doing it during the development, we would wait until after the council has submitted the amendment to us and that we've published a proposed rule stating we're going to use that information.
Thank you, Mark. That's a lot clearer. So, I mean, the process for permit holders that we're familiar with now is really the same. It's just prior history under a different ownership of that permit.
Correct. And just to highlight again, we are proposing that we would put out basically language you could use for that confidential release and let you comment on that so we could develop a standardized language that could be used for that.
Thank you.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, just a little more clarification. In a perfect world, what we'd like is if the council intends to do a sector program or an IFQ program, under NEPA there will be several different qualification periods or allocation periods based on certain qualifications. So there may be five. And, you know, in the industry, as well as the council and staff, but primarily the industry, would like to know how each of those five different qualification periods affect their allocation, whether it's into ACE for a sector or an IFQ. So what you're saying is that there will be, if we present five different qualification periods, you won't be able to give the public or the industry what each of those means to that member so they can provide input. Is that correct? You have to wait until we choose one of those criteria?
As proposed, yes, you'd have to actually submit the document to us and we'd have to publish a proposed rule. It specifically states that simply considering development would not allow us to use this exception as it's proposed.
Dave Gaethel. Gene.
You can still get your own data. I mean, if it's your, if you're the submitter of it, if you're the person that submitted the data, you're allowed to see your own submitted data. You can't get prior owner's data, though, that might have been purchased by the potential permit applicant.
Dave Gaethel.
My question is really the same one I had, I think I talked to you about before. The release of information on marine mammals and endangered species, even though it doesn't identify the vessel directly, because these are rare events and people could piece together information, they could in fact identify the vessel directly, and because of the nature of Endangered Species Act, a zealous citizen could use this as a means of bringing a citizen suit against an individual vessel. So I think this is something the council is going to want to comment on extensively. There are a lot of these things have a lot of pitfalls in them that people probably don't understand and need to be thought through very carefully, lest we get ourselves into the law of unintended consequences. So is that my, I know my question's kind of long, but is my interpretation of that, in fact, correct?
I don't want to go too far down interpreting the proposed rule because it's in a comment period. It does specifically state that we couldn't release information identifying the owner. I understand the point you're making is that perhaps by saying the gear type, location, and date, somebody could work that out themselves. I think you'd have to ask for specific clarification in a comment saying, in that situation, would you then protect it because it allows me to be identified, or would you then release it?
Thank you, Mark. I think, again, for the council and the people present, when we make comments, you've got to consider this very carefully. Identifying a vessel specifically under the terms of the Endangered Species Act and potentially Marine Mammal Protection Act could be problematic for the vessel.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, in your last slide, the title was limited to disclosure. That means the disclosure is limited to that group of people in the slide, or that group of people is entitled to some limited subset of the data?
Sorry, that was a title I created to fit it in the box. This basically are instances where we are allowed to release information in certain instances, and then there's the potential or possibility it could go into the public record depending how it is used. So that would be things like law enforcement if they need to use specific information as part of, say, a court proceeding, then there's the possibility that becomes part of the public record. But they're basically specified instances. And then, for instance, the releases to state employees or to Fisheries Commission employees for the use in fisheries management, I refer to it as limited because while it is released to them, they have signed an agreement that they will maintain that confidentiality and not release it further on.
But they're not limited as to the data they have access to.
I don't believe the rule actually goes into that level of depth, so it would just defer to what's in the current agreements and current interpretation.
Mary Beth.
So just a little further on that observer data. The rule seems to make a distinction between field notes and data collection as being separate things and not releasable. And as far as, you know, sharing information with state agencies, if you're going to make that distinction, I'm assuming that state agencies, for example, entities that could receive information would only be receiving the data information that's releasable, and the field notes and such would not be released to those entities either, to anyone. Is that correct?
I'm not sure exactly, but what the rule does specify in that instance or proposes is that because it was exempted from that, it would then come under FOIA where it would be protected. I don't know how that would be interpreted to a state partner versus the general public, though. I would defer that to a comment.
And just one other thing. Do you know how the agency would be dealing with things such as photographs and film, video, things like that?
I honestly don't know for that.
Anyone else in the council? Anyone in the audience have a question or comment? Maggie?
Thank you. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. Associated Fisheries of Maine is comprised of 22 individual vessel owners who own 35 active vessels in the groundfish fishery, and our membership also includes several processors, marine insurers and lenders, and a fuel, gear, and ice dealer. My question really was for you, Mr. Chairman, if the council will be developing a committee to develop comments on this proposed rule.
Thank you for that. When we got to the end of the questions, if we're there now, I was going to indicate that I've asked Paul to send out an email to all of the council members to have them get comments back to Paul. A letter will be crafted and passed through the executive committee because the comments have to be in before we have another full council meeting. But that is the way we were going to do it. Back to the council. Any further questions? Okay. And I think everybody understands that Paul will be sending out the email, so get your responses back to him as soon as possible. I think you'll probably put a deadline on that. Okay. All right. Does that conclude the regional administrator's report? Thank you. Gene.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we had a nice spell with no new lawsuits, but that spell was broken in the past couple of weeks. Oceana filed a lawsuit challenging the agency's approval of the sector operations plan final rule, basically on the grounds that the final rule did not adequately justify or explain the level of observer coverage that the agency proposed for sector vessels in order to monitor their catch for ACL, ACE purposes. The agency had established a total of about 25% observer coverage for these vessels, and the lawsuit alleges that the rule approving the sector operations plan didn't explain that that was sufficient coverage. And as a remedy to this, or as the relief that the plaintiff is seeking, is to remand the final rule to the agency so that it can prepare and justify a coverage level that would be shown by record evidence to be sufficient to provide accurate, precise, and timely reporting of bycatch necessary to monitor ACLs determine when AMs are appropriate and for enforcing those ACLs. Another update in connection with Flaherty v. Locke, which was the challenge to Herring Amendment 4. In that case, which I reported on at the last council meeting, I believe, the court held in part for the agency and in part for the plaintiff. The court found that NIMS did not satisfy its obligation to independently determine whether the council's designations of stocks in the fishery complied with the Madison-Stevens Act. NIMS and the amendment did not adequately consider whether it complied with National Standard 9 dealing with impacts on communities and so forth. Wait, that's not National Standard 9. And also, as to NEPA analysis, the court found that NIMS failed to consider the environmental impacts of alternatives to the proposed ABC control rule and accountability measures. The court did not issue a remedy in the case based on its decision, but instead asked the parties to submit potential remedies that might be appropriate in light of the findings. The agency worked a little bit with the plaintiffs to see if they can come up with a mutually agreeable remedy. That was not possible. And so each party submitted its proposed remedies to the court. And the court has not yet ruled on or issued a decision on what the appropriate remedy or what the remedy would be in the case. So we are still waiting for the court decision in that case. And by the way, National Standard 9 has to do with the bycatch, minimizing bycatch to the extent practicable. So that's where we are in that particular decision. And that, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Yes, Paul?
Paul, did you have a question?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Gene, what can you share the remedies offered by the service and by Mr. Flaherty?
The agency submitted a remedy proposal that would basically remand the amendment in the EA back to ensure that it is consistent with the actions stated in the court's opinion. Specifically, the agency proposed that within 1 month of the order on the remedy, which we haven't gotten yet, NIMS would file a supplemental explanation as to whether Amendment 4's definition of what constitutes stocks in the fishery complied with the MSA, that within 1 month of the decision, NIMS would send a letter to the council asking it to consider whether river herring and shad should be designated as non-target stocks in the fishery. The remedy proposal also was proposed that NIMS would request the council to consider a range of alternatives for Atlantic herring ABC, ACLs, and AMs in the NEPA analysis for the fishing year 13 to 15 specifications. And also we propose that Amendment 4 should remain in place while complying with these various remedies. The plaintiff asked the court to vacate the amendment, in other words, wipe it off the books, but to stay that vacature for 1 year so that the federal defendants could take the next necessary action to include river herring as a stock in the fishery, to address bycatch adequately, to consider alternatives that would establish science-based ACLs for Atlantic herring with adequate AMs. And they asked the court that, and explained to the court that this could be done either through Amendment 5, through the next specification process, or other timely actions.
Follow-up, Paul?
Just, that was my point, that Amendment 4 said ACLs, AMs, and we split it off to do Amendment 5, and part of my frustration was this lawsuit deals with Amendment 4, but it's all about the substance of Amendment 5. So I'm not so sure how smart the court is, but Amendment 5 is moving forward, not Amendment 4.
Right.
This deals with taking back Amendment 4, not Amendment 5.
Right, and that's the point that we tried to make to the court as well.
Dave Gaisel.
Yeah, Gene, where was this latest Oceana suit file? What district?
D.C. Circuit, I think.
Okay, my comment and request would be, is it possible to request a change of venue to the First District Court? There's a frustration on the part of the fishing industry that we're, in effect, We're not given due process in these lawsuits that are filed in D.C. It is prohibitively expensive to travel as a fisherman to Washington, D.C. to participate. These are New England issues. They should be heard in the New England District Court, which is Boston. And so is that possible?
Not at this stage, no. I mean, that's something you would do at the beginning stages of the lawsuit. And courts, we've actually done that in a couple of instances. We did it actually in connection with Oceana's, where we attempted to do that in connection with Oceana's challenge to Amendment 16. We asked for a change to the Boston Federal District Court in part because there was also the lawsuit by the industry on the same amendment, and that we thought it would be more appropriate for the reasons that you said, but as well to integrate and allow one court to consider all the issues brought by both the Oceana environmental side and the industry side. We were turned down in that request. And generally, as long as a plaintiff can show that the lawsuit is brought in a jurisdiction where federal government takes actions, and that's the case, you know, these are approved at a level of the government or of the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA, that occurs in the District of Columbia area, then the courts generally will allow a plaintiff to bring a lawsuit there. So we have attempted to do that a few times, and most recently in connection with Amendment 16, and we're not successful. But I understand your concern.
Okay. Thank you. I'll just note for the record, and it's more than a concern. In this particular case, I think sectors as organizations have a vested interest in the outcome of this lawsuit, and in essence, they're not allowed the ability to participate. I mean, my sector doesn't have the money to send our sector manager to Washington, D.C. It costs a minimum of $1,500 a day to go to that place between the air flight, the hotels, and the food. And we just simply don't have the money. So, you know, these NGOs are deep-pocketed organizations. They could certainly file these lawsuits in a place where everybody can participate. So, you know, I'll just note for the record my frustration with Oceana and this process that doesn't allow us to participate.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just back to the Amendment 4 lawsuit very quickly. My understanding was that the court found that we had not considered a range of alternatives for our ABC control rule. And as I recall the process, we ended up, because of the status of the assessment, with a proxy that was recommended by the SSC. And I'm just curious on the remedy, Gene. You referenced that we would that the agency's proposed remedy would have us reconsidering alternatives for ABC ACL AMs for specifications year 13 through 15. But do you really mean we just need to have a range of alternatives in our spec package that considers a control rule for ABC? Is that correct?
Well, the way it's stated is that we would consider a range of alternatives in the NEPA analysis during the spec process. I mean, that's all that we proposed in that regard. So it doesn't dictate the outcome. It just says that we'll expand, if it already isn't done, the analysis to consider these alternatives for that spec process, or during in that particular federal action.
So if I could, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up. So my reading was that when we consider, you know, how we're going to determine an ABC or how our PDT puts together the information they take to the SSC for that determination, there needs to be a range. But it doesn't mean we need to have, like, ABC, ACLs, and AMs to have ranges at every stage. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how broadly we're going to need to go down into alternatives in our spec package, because I thought the court's, you know, decision was specific to this control rule only.
Well, I mean, we'll have to work that out if we get this remedy and figure out what the most practical way to implement this would be. I think the idea is just to sort of do the analysis to show the court that there is a range of alternatives that could be considered, and because the court found that wasn't sufficiently done in the amendment. So this is sort of a vehicle for doing that. You know, the details of how it's done is something that, you know, I can't get into at this time because I don't know off the top of my head how that would, you know, what that means.
And just finally, quickly here, I'm just wondering, we have control rules in other plans depending on the status of the assessment. We have a new assessment coming up for Herring, so I think we're going to be moving forward with one. Did we consider a range of alternatives in any of them? Or did we just, I mean, I don't recall that. I thought, you know, the assessment or the process, I mean, maybe Jim recalls. I mean, the process of determining an ABC control rule has been a combination of science and policy, I suppose, but a range? I hadn't thought we had done that in our plans.
Chris?
No, I think actually the confusion stems from the way we got Herring ABC recommendations. If you recall, the SSC originally gave the council a single recommendation, and the council asked the SSC to reconsider what the definition of recent historical catch. And the SSC responded by saying that you could define recent historical catch as 1 year, 3 years, or 5 years, depending on the level of risk the council was willing to consider. My understanding of the the suit is because the council was given a range, that range should have been analyzed in the amendment. But in the SSC is often not given the council a range, and at that point the council does not have alternatives to work with. So in that circumstance, the council might not be required to, the SSC may not be required to provide the council a range. I'm not sure whether the council then has to look at alternatives, including some alternatives that might be lower than the upper limit that they can set under Magnuson. Now, I don't know if I've clarified it or made it more confusing for you, Mary Beth. But I do have the concern because I don't think that, I'm not sure that we can require the SSC to give us a range unless we put it in a terms of reference for the ABC recommendation. They may not meet our terms of reference. We don't necessarily have that control.
Anyone else on the council for Gene? David?
Well, the court has already received, I believe you said, Gene, the service's suggestion for a proposed remedy. I guess I'm unclear as to what that specific suggestion was relative to the stocks in the fishery element of the lawsuit. Could you repeat that again? What was the specific?
What we proposed was that within a month of the court's order on the remedy, assuming that the court adopts this proposal, NIMS shall send a letter to the council requesting that the council consider in an amendment to the Atlantic Herring FMP whether river herring and shad should be designated as non-target stocks based on developments which have arisen after Amendment 4 was issued. That's how it's written in the order. So we're asking the council to consider it. We're not demanding that they do it, but asking them to consider it in an amendment.
Okay. I suggest that when the service receives the council's comments on the ANPR relative to stocks in the fishery, that might throw a monkey wrench into how you move forward. The text that's that will be in the letter, at least proposed so far, makes it very clear that council should not be required to set ACLs for stocks in a fishery that are primarily under the jurisdiction of other management authorities such as NIMS, state commissions, and then it goes on from there. So perhaps the the question has already been answered or will be answered through the council's comments on that announcement of proposed rulemaking.
Well, I mean, again, we will send a letter asking you to consider it. You can respond any way you want. I don't know if that is the... It means that you've already decided to do that in light of the letter that we would send. You know, there's a lot of hypotheticals here. We haven't even been issued a remedy order yet, so we don't even know if that's going to be adopted by the court.
Okay. Anyone else dying to ask Gene a question? Seeing no hands up, it's close to the 90 minutes. We will take a 10-minute break and come back and wrap up the rest of the reports. Now that most everyone is back, the Science Center seems otherwise occupied at the moment. Okay. Northeast Science Center. Bill, is it you or Jim?
Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple of items, and then I'll pass it on to Jim. The first is informational for the council. The center's in the process of a strategic planning exercise, and it's one that's being conducted in parallel with all of the other science centers now that we have a new chief scientist, and clearly we're going to be faced with some resource limitations and some issues with regard to prioritization next year and in the out years. And what I would like to be able to do is come back to both of the councils actually at the full meetings with a draft of the plan and to seek input from the councils. So my question really is how best to do that, whether to do that around the table during the agency report, to have a session in an evening or whatever, but just to offer that opportunity to the council and to be able to work with you on some way of facilitating that. So if people have questions about that, or I could go on to my next item.
Why don't we just go on to the next one, and we'll take sort of questions at the end, if that's okay with you.
Certainly. The other is just follow-up to the action that the council took at the last meeting regarding the HABCAM Sea Scallop survey methodology. And you'll recall that the council took action to ask the SSC to move forward with a review of the HABCAM survey methodology and there were some other details to that. And after going back to the center and talking to staff, we are collectively very supportive of the need for that review. But we also thought that it would be perhaps that we would offer the council an alternative, which would be to look more comprehensively at the scallop survey methodologies and survey designs. As you all know, there are a number of different tools that we use in the surveys, the dredge, the drop cam, HABCAM, in some cases a little bit of work with AUVs. And we thought having a more comprehensive review of all of the methods, the survey design, and how the surveys inform the stock assessment would be perhaps a good idea. And so what we would like to offer the council as an alternative is that the center would take the responsibility for having that carried out in the normal peer review way, but we would develop terms of reference and work with the SSC and the council to fine-tune those terms of reference with the intent of, of having their peer review sometime either late this year or early next year.
There are any questions for Dr. Carr? Dr. Pierce.
I appreciate that suggestion, that way to move forward. Again, it sounds very reasonable, and I would support it provided that this peer review that would be undertaken involving the SSC would address the three tasks that was assigned to the SSC by the council through our motion at our last meeting. And that was to task the SSC to review the HABCAM survey technology and methods, to determine that the HABCAM is appropriate at this time for performing annual Sea Scallop surveys. Secondly, to review how the HABCAM results will be integrated into the Sea Scallop assessments for determining biomass and fishing mortality. And three, determine the impacts on assessments of reduced survey coverage from current dredge and SMAS video surveys. So those were the three very specific tasks that the council felt needed to be accomplished through the SSC. So, again, if this peer review will involve addressing those specific tasks along with the broader look, then I feel comfortable with that approach.
Mr. Chairman, if the council so pleases, we could certainly include those as terms of reference and then add additional terms of reference, but bring them back for review before we finalize the remit to the peer review panel.
Thank you. Mary Beth.
Mr. Chairman, we have a motion that we passed relative to this. I don't know if we need to take any action. And certainly we could reconsider that motion under other business on Thursday, perhaps, or if we can just, like, not do anything. I'm not really sure. I think the Science Center's recommendation is actually a much better process than what we had contemplated, so certainly very supportive of that. But we do have that motion. I'm not sure if we need to do anything with it.
Well, certainly since the motion was asking that the SSC take a look at it, and if they're going to have the SSC do the peer review of the HABCAM work, seems to me that in fact is answering or doing what we asked in that motion. Anyone else for Dr. Carp?
Mr. Chairman, our suggestion, in fact, was to use the CIE or CIE-like process so that we could bring in people who really had the kind of expertise in survey methodology that might be more broad-based than the SSC could bring to bear.
Thank you. I misunderstood you. Let's talk about whether we need to review that under other business at the end of the meeting. I'll put it on my list. Dr. Jim?
Thank you. I'll be reviewing survey activities and then stock assessment that are on schedule. First of all, the 2012 spring multi-species bottom trawl survey took place from February the 28th through May the 5th. The survey data should just be coming available this week. The sea scallop survey is underway on the SHARP. It began on June the 1st and will be completed on July the 7th. And it's a combination of traditional scallop dredge tows as well as using the HABCAM system. Other surveys which are coming up are the shrimp survey from July the 22nd till August the 18th. There is a industry cooperative clam survey scheduled from August the 1st through August the 21st, and the annual herring acoustic survey is scheduled from September the 12th through October the 20th. And at this time, it's unclear what vessel will be used to support the acoustic survey, as the Delaware has finished its field work and is being retired. On assessment activities, we have just completed the spring SARC from June the 5th to the 9th, and two benchmark stock assessments were peer-reviewed, Southern New England Yellowtail Flounder and Herring. The track is taking place next week on the shared stocks on George's Bank for cod, haddock, and yellowtail flounder. And the center is also actively engaged in doing assessment updates for a number of mid-Atlantic stocks. For this upcoming fall and winter, this is a little bit uncertain still. We're having discussions at the NRCC level still on what stocks will be assessed, but at the moment, it looks like in late November, early December, SARC 55 will include Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod. And then we're having discussions about potentially adding a SARC in February, which would include White Hake and Atlantic Surf Clam. But this is a bit complicated because there are some other requests from this council to do some additional updates of New England groundfish. And hopefully we'll work out that situation in the next week or two. And then in the first half of 2013, SARC 56 or 7 will be striped bass and summer flounder. And that concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Questions for Dr. Jim? Okay. Thank you. Mary Beth?
Not a question, just a comment. And, you know, certainly we have tried to encourage the industry to participate in science, and the process of stock assessments is, you know, benchmark assessments is fairly lengthy. The efforts the center puts into them are lots of resources and time. And I found it very difficult this go around to be able to attend all the meetings. And I don't think it's, you know, not the fault of anyone in particular. You know, just one of those things. But I'm just wondering if the council could perhaps take a role in laying out a calendar that's available to the industry of when all these meetings take place. I mean, we do have a calendar, but if we could try to move towards a more comprehensive calendar, I think it would be easier for everyone to see conflicts beforehand, to the extent that we're never going to be able to do away with all of them, but we could try. And it also, I think, would provide to the industry a place to go, and they would realize, you know, what's pending for stock assessments, when data meetings take place, and modeling meetings, and all of these different things that go into the process. So to the extent maybe that we could do that in the future, I think it would be helpful.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess it's a question for Jim. The hake gets done when you're proposing. When would that be completed?
Well, we really haven't set a final agreed on a final date for the White Hake benchmark assessment. But one of the proposals we are making is that the benchmark be done in February of 2013. And we haven't worked out the date in February for that. But if it were done, then there would be the typical time for delivery. After the meeting ends, then there's approximately a six-week period where reviewer reports are coming in, and I would say about 6 weeks after the meeting, we would have a publication and a public presentation.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we're going to move on to Mid-Atlantic Liaison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met last week in New York City, which was a very uneventful meeting. Well, that's not true at all, but after what we thought was an explosion and then gunshots. Mary Beth was a trooper. I think she should be the new committee chairman of either the Emergency Preparedness or Survival Training Committee, as she barricaded herself under the table with the chair. So I kind of failed because most of my notes and everything are left in the room down there, so I'll do the best I can. I might need some help from my Middle Air counterparts. Okay. The council recommended to do away the elimination of the minimum size for surf clams. They sent that to the service. Mackerel specs, they set for 3 years. Forward to that. Butterfish voted for an increase in the quota, which should allow for approximately 1 million pounds for a directed fishery. There hasn't been a directed fishery of butterfish, I think, since 2001. So that's good news for that. Hopefully a post-season trip limit from 250 to 750 pounds, and also put a trigger of 75% of the butterfish cap in trimester two for the squid fishery. Last year, the fishery closed. Hopefully this will keep the squid fishery open in trimester three. The council voted to submit Amendment 14 in the mackerel fishery to the secretary for approval. They did not include river herring and shad as stocks in the fishery. They voted to start work on Amendment 15, which will probably start at the next council meeting to take up that issue. I won't go into too many details on the mackerel. I'm sure we'll hear some more of that when we get into herring, on how it goes in with our herring amendment. The monkfish committee, they met on monkfish. The council did not agree with the New England position on removing the ITQs from the monkfish amendment. So I'm sure we'll be getting a letter from them, or Rick can tell us what we're going to do there. And that was basically the highlights of the meeting. If there's any questions.
Chairman Robbins, you have anything to add? Or?
No, as Frank pointed out, you know, it really was an explosive meeting. As you go through Amendment 5 tomorrow, I'll be sure to have a copy of all of our motions, and if there are any questions about, trying to map some of the options in the two amendments out, I'll try to be prepared to comment on that. I'm sure Lori Steele and your staff, I think she listened in to the webinar as well, so... I assume she probably has a copy of those, but to the extent that there's a lot of overlap there, I'll try to be prepared to comment on some of those details. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave Gaito, then Mary Beth.
Frank, good news on the butterfish. Did they change the incidental possession limit as well? I think it's currently 500 pounds.
After the closure, it was going to go 250 to 500, but there was also a trip limit of 2,500 pounds would mesh less than 3 inches, and 5,000 pound would mesh of greater than 3 inches.
Okay, so they did change it. This is relatively important to New England now, because with the change in temperatures, butterfish are expanded quite a ways to the north, and even though we only have incidental permits, we're catching a lot of butterfish, so... it's changed to 2,500 is what you said, right? Under 3 inch?
Under 3 inch was 2,500.
Okay, thank you.
I get that. Okay.
Well, I guess I'm not going to comment on the explosive nature of the meeting, but it was very interesting. But on the Amendment 14 and how it may affect our decisions tomorrow, I just remind the council that Lori did send out a list of motions to everyone yesterday morning, and she's also indicated in the decision document that she since has sent to all of us that she's incorporated those decisions in there as well. So it's good that we have the chairman of the MID with us for our discussion tomorrow. I think that will help, and I think Lori's also tried to provide the information so it's useful for us as well.
Anyone else? Okay. Captain DeCola, Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, I would like to tell the council that we have a new admiral in the 1st Coast Guard District. On the 30th of May, Admiral Dan Abel relieved Admiral Neptune. We tried to get him to this council meeting, but to address you, but his schedule as a brand new admiral is a little full this time of year. So we're on track to bring him to the September council meeting, and he'll get a chance to meet you and address you at that time. For the period 1 April to 18 June, we conducted 317 boardings and issued 6 violations of a significant nature for an observed compliance rate of 98.1%, which is very close to our last reported compliance rate. And from the safety side, during those same 317 boardings, we issued 42 safety violations for an 86.8% compliance rate, which is similar to the last reporting period. We issued 8 voyage terminations, primarily for lack of life rafts, fire extinguishers, and no life jackets on board. We also responded to 31 casualties and 14 medical evacuations, assisting 106 fishermen, and fortunately we had one fatality during the period. That concludes my report. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Kevin. Enforcement VMS?
Taking some risk here, bringing my laptop to the table. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the council. I am Bill Semro. I'm with Northeast Division of Law Enforcement. I'm the Northeast VMS Program Manager in Gloucester. The Northeast VMS team is monitoring a total of 1,054 active vessels. Back in April, I reported to you that the VMS software change supporting Scallop Framework 23 was postponed indefinitely. The issue causing the delay has been sufficiently resolved, so we're now able to move forward. I have held several software implementation meetings with the regional office staff, primarily the Sustainable Fisheries Division. And in addition to the Scallop Framework 23 changes, I'll also be rolling in the following changes at the request of the NERO, Northeast Regional Office. From Groundfish Framework 47, we'll be removing the common pool restricted gear area forms. Secondly, from the fishing year 2012 sector exemption number 17, providing additional flexibility that allows exempted sector vessels to declare and fish both inside and outside the closed area 1 hook gear haddock sap on the same trip. And from exemption 20, that allows exempted sector vessels to declare at sea and fish in the eastern U.S. Canada SAP and the closed area 2 yellowtail flounder haddock SAP. These changes will also drive related changes to the monkfish declaration screen. Given the additional flexibility that's been granted to the sector fishery over the last few years, we're at the point where it makes sense to develop separate sector and common pool declaration screens. And we're moving in that direction for this next software rollout. We're also changing the format of these declaration screens to try and make them easier to understand, and we're engaging a few fishermen to give us some feedback. We're also looking at expanding the declare out of fishery declaration under the RA's authority to differentiate it for transit, commercial fishing not covered by a VMS species declaration, recreational slant charter fishing, research, and NAFO, Northwest Atlantic Fisheries Organization. We feel these declarations could help monitoring and compliance efforts by giving us a better understanding of the intent of a trip declared under DOF. And finally, within the software change, in order to assist sector managers in developing a greater understanding of fishing activity within the inshore Gulf of Maine, we are considering adding an additional one or two free text fields to the Trip Start Hail form to be used as they deem appropriate. The Trip Start Hail is not a NIMS requirement, however many sectors continue to require this form. My plan is to submit the software changes to the VMS vendors by July 1 with an effective date of September 1. We're coordinating the rollout with the Southeast Region's VMS change for their HMS rule, and the goal is for the VMS vendors to send out just one software update by September 1st, which will include both the northeast and the southeast changes. And that completes my report, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Are there questions? Dave?
Yes, thanks, Bill. I've had some questions recently. There seems to be some confusion on the part of fishing industry members about what forms they have to file. Some people thought they had to file a trip start and not a trip end. Some still have confusion about the catch report. So a possible suggestion would be to send out a letter just explaining what forms you do have to file under what conditions, because there does seem to be some misinformation floating around, you know, and I think people want to comply. They just a lot of times are confused.
Okay, thanks, Dave. By the way, there is an operator instruction on the use of VMS and what forms are required on the VMS webpage. That would be a good start for folks to go there, but I realize not everybody's tech savvy. So I'll keep that in mind. I know we'll be putting out a permanent holder letter, the regional office will, and I'll be providing some input to that for the software change. So we'll consider those suggestions for that letter.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you, Bill. ASMFC, do we have any report from that? Dr. Pierce.
The ASMFC spring meeting was held about a month and a half ago. One of the more notable events occurring at the meeting was a change in the leadership of ASMFC. Vince O'Shea is no longer the executive director of ASMFC. ASMFC decided to have a change in leadership, and with that change in leadership came a great deal of praise for all of the accomplishments of Executive Director Vince O'Shea for all the years that he has served ASMFC. In his place now, acting as Executive Director, is Bob Beal, who we're sure will be doing a great job in that acting capacity. So that was one of the more notable events at the meeting. He also received some special recognition at an awards program for all of his accomplishments over these last 10 years or so. The sea herring section met, and the section provided some comments to the policy board regarding this council's Amendment 5, and comments I believe have been received by the council relative to ASMFC's position on the amendment, especially its position relative to river herring bycatch. For example, the section offered some support for the SMAS, Division of Marine Fisheries, Sustainable Fisheries Coalition River Herring Bycatch Avoidance Program, and council members will hear more of that program tomorrow when we discuss the different options in the amendment that are specific to river herring bycatch. We also decided to bring to public hearing some proposed changes to how we actually monitor the spawning condition of sea herring as part of the state's efforts to protect spawning sea herring, our spawning closures. Obviously, this council continues to deal with that particular issue in other areas, and perhaps eventually we'll have spawning closures in Georges Bank. But for now, it's ASMFC that is providing that protection, as well as providing the means by which the overall ACL set by this council are prolonged in terms of their not being caught right away. The council is well aware of our days allowed for fishing, our days allowed for landing. That's how we've been spreading out the catch over the seasons. By the way, there'll be a meeting early in July by the three states, Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, to discuss whether or not we need to reduce the number of days, if indeed the effort in the sea herring fishery is anticipated to escalate this summer. So we'll make a decision on that early in July. The ASMFC River Herring Board also met, and like the sea herring section, provided some comments relative to the sea herring amendment, and those comments were forwarded, were combined with the sea herring section comments and submitted to this council. I call your attention to the benchmark assessment that was done and accepted for management use in May of this year. It's very relevant to our discussions about what to do with river herring. Those discussions are occurring tomorrow. I won't highlight what's in that document except to say that you should reference page 9 of the summary of our meeting. That's in the correspondence section of the binder, number 1, that provides a, sort of a capsule summary of what ASMSC has concluded to do with that particular assessment. Sturgeon. On page 15 of the summary, you'll notice a motion that is essentially the same as the motion of this council adopted at our last meeting, except in this particular case, the emphasis was on requesting that the National Marine Fisheries Service, their protected species staff, interact with the ASMFC Sturgeon Technical Committee. Clearly, all the discussions this council has had about sturgeon relates to the service, you know, the SSC and others, but in this particular case, it's important for our technical committee to be more involved now with what has happened with sturgeon, notably the listing. So that motion was passed unanimously by the board, and I suspect that ASMSC will receive a similar letter to the one that Dan has sent to this council that we briefly reviewed earlier this morning. On lobsters, I'll only note one thing, and that is page 17 of the summary. The policy board is going to or has sent a letter to this council expressing commission concern about the potential impacts on the lobster resource if closed Area 2 is open to bottom tending mobile gear. So that was one of the more notable decisions made regarding lobster that's pertinent to this council. Spiny dogfish. We decided to, the ASMFC Spiny Dogfish Board decided to follow the wise decisions and actions of this council and the Mid-Atlantic Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service by revisiting the quota for spiny dogfish in the current fishing year, and we decided to increase the quota from 30 million pounds up to both councils and the service's decision to go with the 35.6 million pounds. That increased quota, therefore, is now in place. That summarizes, I believe, the more notable and pertinent ASMFC actions.
Questions for Dr. Pierce? Doug.
Just a little bit more detail on the river herring stock assessment that I think the council should take into consideration for tomorrow's Amendment 5 decisions. As you're aware, we had the committee had been hoping that we would that this river herring stock assessment would come up with a coastwide estimate of river herring abundance, so that we could potentially in the future set a biologically based river herring cap. The Stock Assessment Committee could not do that, primarily because there are many, many rivers for which there's no information. And even of the 52 that they actually had information, there were 28 that didn't even have enough information that they could determine status levels for those individual rivers. So at least for now, we will not in any foreseeable future have any kind of biological basis for setting any kind of river herring catch cap. Thank you.
Terry Stockwell, then Paul Howard.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one additional report. Subsequent to the spring meeting, the shrimp section met to initiate an addendum which will provide additional management measures for next fishing year. Some of the proposed measures include state-by-state, gear-type, individual and or group allocations, limited entry, trawl gear modifications, and alternative measures to close the fishery, including payback provisions. The commission is in the process of developing the public document right now. The public hearings will be likely very early September with a section vote in October. So this, whatever is moved ahead, will be implemented prior to next fishing year.
Thank you. Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. Dr. Pierce has mentioned on a number of occasions how important protecting spawning fish is for the state of Massachusetts and ASMFC, and he mentioned herring. And to my knowledge, in the past, we got scientific information from the Science Center that basically said it was not that important to, you know, I want to paraphrase, that if you've got a quota to catch, you know, 20% of the population or whatever your ACL is, it really doesn't make that much difference to protect spawning fish. But I'm wondering if we should ask them to revisit that in light of some of the abundances of some of our stocks and the need to protect spawning. And certainly we should have our ecosystem committee start looking at the importance of protecting spawning fish. I think that old concept of as long as you have a quota, you shouldn't have to worry about spawning aggregations, to me, seems to be a little old now.
Very bad.
I think a question. You're suggesting that perhaps the ecosystem committee look into it as a, you know, across all species? Is that what you were thinking, Paul?
Well, I'm suggesting maybe we get ask the Science Center to update research and talk to us about how important is it to protect, now that we have ACLs and AMs, you know, is it critical that we still consider protecting spawning biomasses of low abundance stocks? How critical is it? And that the council specifically address spawning in its when it addresses ecosystem management, the need to protect spawning aggregations.
I think it's a good suggestion. I think that, you know, protecting spawning fish sometimes is a science discussion, sometimes it's a policy discussion. For herring, we have, you know, directed fisheries on spawn herring around the world. It certainly does change, however, if you want to do that, what you're going to remove from the population and to maintain sustainable, you know, levels. I think it's a combination, and my thinking, you know, here has been the advice from the Science Center had been that if, in the case of Atlantic herring, where the population is not overfished, overfishing is not occurring, that was sort of the rationale why we did not have, you know, federal spawning measures, you know, so relative to population size. So anyway, I think I agree with Paul's suggestion.
Thank you. Anyone else on it? Dave?
Just that I wholeheartedly agree, not only for river not only for sea herring, but also for codfish. That's another burning issue. But certainly for sea herring, and I reflect on my long history with sea herring science and with management, that in the 1970s, and actually early in the 1970s, many papers were written by Northeast Fishery Science Center scientists who were quite adept with the sea herring research, and ICNAF publications that made the point that the reason why the Georges Bank sea herring resource collapsed was foreign fishing on spawning fish. Yeah, there were quotas, but at the same time, fishing on spawning fish, especially when the resource is relatively low in abundance, it's not a wise idea. And I await the results of the sea herring assessment to determine where we stand right now with status of the stocks. And if the status of the stocks are not as good as we think they are, that would then escalate the need to focus on the point that Paul has made. So, Mr. Chairman, if you have a suggestion as to how we could move that forward, I would appreciate that.
I do. Assume that we've concluded the report section, and there are two items now. My understanding is next item is not going to take the full hour. So one would be this item. My suggestion would be that we'll try it this way. Without objection, we would request that the executive director craft a letter to the Science Center requesting that they update their opinion on the impacts of fishing on spawning fish. So if nobody objects to that, then we will go ahead and get that done. Okay, so that's the first item. The second item, since I had that on my list to address the SSC motion at the end, we've got a little bit of time now. My suggestion would be that I would entertain a motion that the Science Center's review, CIE review of the sea scallop HABCAM would fulfill the request made by the council to the SSC to do the same task, something of that sort, and then we could resolve that. Dr. Pierce.
I was going to say so moved.
Did you get all that language?
I got it all.
Is that just a review of HABCAM, or was that a review of all assessment methods that are currently used?
Well, my understanding, again, if I heard Dr. Karp correctly, that they would incorporate the three items that were in that motion. One, the review of the sea scallop HABCAM technology and methods. Two, review how the HABCAM results would be integrated into the sea scallop assessment. And three, determine the impacts on assessments of reduced survey coverage from the current dredge and SMAS video surveys, which were in there, that they would be part of the TORs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they would be part of the TORs, but our intent would be to be broader in our reach. And that was actually, I outlined this suggestion in a letter that I sent to Paul after the last council meeting, so it should be part of the record.
Just the reason I asked is whether or not this language actually fulfills that statement.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I could just read a couple of lines here from the letter, which might be a little bit more descriptive of at least what we had in mind, so that the council better understands. So what I have here is that we believe that a broad and inclusive peer review is warranted, and that this review should consider all of the resource survey information needs to support scallop stock assessment and management, and the sampling approaches and technologies available to meet these needs. And we could then say including these specific items, if you wish, the ones that were in the original motion, just to make sure that those are covered. But that would give a better sense of the intent here.
Okay. First item is, I can't make the motion. I was entertaining the motion. Dr. Pierce would be the maker of the motion, and let's get that crafted, and then we'll get a second for it. Dr. Pierce.
Okay, I would move, you can scratch that one off. I would move that the Northeast Fisheries Science Center's CIE peer review of sea scallop survey work include as terms of reference the council tasks to the SSC regarding the HABCAM. I think that that covers it. The words are not quite the same as those that were offered up by Bill, but...
Will we be either late this show or early next?
I think it captures the intent.
Is there a second? Mary Beth. Discussion. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, what would be the approximate time frame to get this moving?
Mr. Chairman, Paul, we would like to do this late this year or early next. We're going to have to work around, of course, the schedules for our benchmark stock assessments, but that's the general time frame that we're thinking about.
Dave Gaethel.
I think this motion is general enough to include what's necessary, but I would like the discussion to reflect that Dr. Kopp read a more extensive list of items to be covered so that we make sure that they are included, because I think that list sounded like a good list to me of things that need to be addressed.
Right, and I mean, I think also it should be understood the intent of this is to deal with a motion that we already have sitting there that we refer this to the SSC, and that this, our feeling is that this takes care of that as well as doing some other things. Okay, David.
Yeah, regarding the timing of a CIEP review, obviously this is going to take some time, some planning, as Bill indicated. Towards the end of this year, maybe early next year. I would much prefer that the SSC address these issues earlier than that. However, I'm realistic, and I recognize the restraints on the service, the center specifically, and I'm very appreciative of the initiative that's been offered up by Dr. Karp. So with that, with my recognizing their internal constraints, that this, again, this seems to be a very reasonable way to move forward to accomplish the tasks that we have set for the SSC in a more comprehensive way. So,
thank you. I'll go to the audience. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. I think this... is a good idea, but it only deals with a part of the issue. You know, we had that scallop survey advisory panel where all the participants in all the surveys actively participated and discussed the issues. The main concern, I mean, there's obviously the HABCAM needs to undergo a scientific peer review. But a lot of the concerns have to do with dollars and resources. How much money is NOAA going to put behind a system that's worth, it's going to cost millions of dollars to maintain? Are they going to put on permanent staff to maintain it? How are they going to analyze the data? Where are they going to get the funding resources for that? And in a world of limited resources, I mean, we have five levels of surveys in the scallop fishery. If they say HABCAM is the best thing since sliced bread, they're going to do away with the SMAS, you know, who's going to make the decision not to fund the SMAS video survey through RSA funds, which is industry. I mean, there's a lot of things going on here, not just a scientific question. So I'm just concerned that we're going to be spending a lot of time and resources and might not be really addressing the real issues that are not coming to the forefront. It's a lot of the questions are not scientific. They're about how do we do resource surveys, five different methodologies. Do we eliminate some? You know, it's funding issues. I'm worried that we're going down one path and ignoring the other. I mean, what's probably the driving forces.
Thank you, Ron. I just want to make a comment on that, and I'm not speaking for the Science Center. We were trying to resolve an outstanding motion issue that we had. I think that some of the discussion that we had when that motion was made in the scallop segment was on exactly what you were talking about. So, you know, I understand what you're saying, but those are issues that... You know, we weren't trying to address in this motion. Anyone else in the audience? Back to the committee. Jim.
Two things. One is I just wanted to point out that Dr. Karp's letter is in the briefing book behind tab 4. It's document 2A. And it wasn't clear that everyone was aware that it was part of the record. And so it is available to be read. The other thing is when Dr. Karp was describing the review, he said a CIE review or a CIE-like peer review. And we've done that kind of thing before where our reviewers have been a mixture of outside experts and some CIE people. And so I don't want to get boxed in to restricting it to CIE members. So I think saying something more general about a CIE-like review would be more appropriate, and it wouldn't exclude people.
Dr. Pierce, is that something you would like to perfect? Or?
Sure, that the center CIE or CIE-like peer review, I recognize that it could go either way. It's going to depend upon, I suppose, how the center feels it should best move forward. So if the CIE review is not the right way to go, but one like the CIE, then sure, especially if it involves more individuals in the review of all the different survey work.
John, so, I think he said CIE or...
CIE-like.
Yeah. Or CIE-like. So it's a New England Science Center CIE or CIE-like review. You can take right there. Perfect. Thank you. Is that all right with the seconder? Okay. Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Fifteen in favor. Opposed? Abstention? 1. 15-01. The motion carries. Okay. We will move on to the update on the SBRM methodology.
Thank you. Doug Potts from the Northeast Regional Office, and chair of the FMAT for this. There was supposed to be an update, this update presented to the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting last week, but because of events that happened, this got bumped from the schedule. So hopefully some people from that who might be interested would be able to catch this online. The previous update that was given in April, it anticipated having council action on alternatives at the June meetings. That schedule has been changed, and at the end of the presentation, we'll get to an updated schedule showing where we are. So we're not expecting action today on the range of alternatives in this action. Excuse me. The FMAT is comprised of members from the regional office, the Science Center, both councils, ASMFC. Since this slide was made, we've actually added a member from the Science Center's fishery sampling branch to bring in expertise on observer deployment, so that'll aid to our discussions in the future. We've had three meetings since we're so widely distributed. Meetings have primarily been through conference call, and we've had some other participants bringing their expertise, and public who has also been able to participate in the calls and add to the discussions. Today's presentation we'll just go through. There are four areas we're potentially we're looking into changing or adding alternatives from the previous SBRM amendment. Primarily, we're focused on the first one, the funding triggers and prioritization alternatives. These are addressing the court order that vacated the previous SBRM amendment that found fault with the prioritization process and the amount of discretion that the agency had in those things. Additionally, we're looking at some changes to what are frameworkable actions in the amendment, and the a minor change to analytical techniques and to the contents of the annual reports to the councils. Those three things, those refinements, are all based out of the three-year review FMAT that took place last year and came up with some suggestions that might improve the process going forward. These touch on four of the seven elements that are built into the SBRM Omnibus Amendment. This slide is actually a little hard to read from here. This is actually a table from the original, the June 2007 SBRM amendment. These cells that are gray and bolded are actually what were the preferred alternatives in that previous amendment. You'll see that we're having some minor changes to those four. Element six, which was the prioritization process, and that's where the court order focused on. We're dealing with funding constraints, the triggers and prioritization alternatives that come out of that. We're also addressing some possible alternatives in element two, which would a modification of the importance filter that was built into that. Item four, there's some changes to the annual reporting requirement, and I said item six, item five, inclusion of new, item five is framework adjustments and how we include new fleets into the process. Those are, again, all out of the three-year review report from last year. At this time, the FMAT's not planning to make any changes to elements one, which had dealt with electronic monitoring, three, which is the CV performance standard, or number seven, which dealt with industry-funded observer programs. Nor are we going to address alternatives, looking to address alternatives that were considered but rejected in the previous amendment. Those would still be under that category, including alternative CV levels, quarterly discard reports, additional mechanisms to collect bycatch information, and this process of the possibility of setting coverage levels based on non-managed species. Currently, the coverage is based on species that are subject to a council FMP or afforded protection under the MMPA or ESA. All bycatch is recorded. These are just the species that are used to set target levels under the 30% CV trigger. First thing off, we're talking about the trigger of funding. The court had said that there was too much agency discretion in how whether or not there was sufficient funding for the, or it was unclear each year whether or not there was enough funding for the SBRM. Under the current status quo, we use a combination. Two alternatives are being considered right now for this: a status quo alternative, which uses the combination of various funding sources and various restrictions or limitations that are on those funding sources to determine what funding is available across all of the different fleets for coverage. Secondarily, we are considering using a dedicated NOAA budget line item. This isn't a congressional line item. It's not an earmark, per se, but it would be a NOAA budget line item specifically targeted to Northeast Region bycatch monitoring. That would be a set figure that would be in the budget, approved by Congress. It would be very clear. It would set minimum coverage levels as that is distributed across through the prioritization process that I'll describe later. Additional funding sources would also potentially be available that could be used to supplement coverage under particular fleets or to address other management priorities, such as in-season ACE monitoring or quota monitoring, other dedications that observer coverage is used for beyond just bycatch monitoring, the SBRM. The prioritization alternatives, we're currently working on four alternatives on how we would allocate observer coverage when there aren't enough resources to meet the 30% CV across all the fleets. The ad hoc approach is actually what was used in the 2012 setting of SBRM coverages. I'll talk about that a little bit. Proportional approach is a proportional reduction across all the fleets. It's been presented previous SBRM CDAY prioritization reports as an example before the other prioritization process is run. What's currently described as the penultimate approach is a new one that the Science Center has worked on, and I'll describe that in a minute. And then the filter cut point approach is one that we've discussed and we're not really supporting going forward, but I'll go into it. It changes how the mortality and total discard filters act across system. All of the impacts of these alternatives, I'll show some examples, were explored using the 2012 data, including funding. In 2012, there were 10,000 So there was a 10,093-day, a 46% shortfall in agency-funded sea days. So that showed as a representation of a year when there may not be enough funding to reach all the targets. As I mentioned, the ad hoc approach, this does separate out funding sources, agency-funded versus industry-funded. Industry-funded including scallop fishery right now. Those days are used for all examples going forward. We're talking strictly about the agency-funded side of coverage. So industry-funded levels would be set and then working within the agency-funded side going forward. The ad hoc approach uses an iterative process, very ad hoc, to identify the fleets and the corresponding funding levels. It allocates sea days within the budget-identified funding constraints, and adjustments are made to unfunded, underfunded or unfunded fleets to meet the various agency and council expectations. So that's the current system that's going through, and that's one of the things that had it was applied in 2012. There are 55 fleets total. That is, 46 are agency-funded, 9 are industry-funded. 44 of the 46 fleets under this system had some impact in this year. 36 of the 44 had days reduced, 8 had days increased, and of the 48 cells, with precision estimates, there were 17 cells that had CVs greater than 30% of the target. In this system, numerous fleets or species groups are impacted. Some have more days than they needed for SBRM, but had other management priorities. Some fleets had fewer days, and it has a lot of agency discretion, and that's one of the issues that the court had raised with that process. A proportional approach is a very formulaic method. It just takes the total number of sea days that we have funded, total days needed, comes up with the percentage shortfall, and then just across the board multiplies each fleet by that proportional shortfall. You could then add some days back if there was additional funding sources that were allowed to do that. For the proportional penultimate and filter cut point approaches, since that was not used this year, it uses a pool of money to assume all of it could be used going across when we go through some of these run-throughs. As I said, all 40 of the 46 agency-funded fleets, all 100% of the fleets get some sea day reduction. 16 cells, in this case, 33%, would have a CD greater than 30%. It impacts all the fleets. It's a proportional decrease across all of them. It does not. The impact is not equal across them with respect to the precision because of the impact on the particular fleets. Although it is non-discretionary, it does end up with a lot of uncertainty in what comes on. The fleet, some fleets could have more days than needed under the discretionary days. Excuse me. More funding allows additional days to be added back. Some focus we've had recently is on this new penultimate approach. It was an effort to sort of get the biggest bang for the buck or save the most money with the least impact. It involves identifying which fleet needs the most sea days across all of them, and then instead of using the maximum number of days, most people are probably familiar with the tables that come out each year by fleet and then by species across the top, and there's across all the numbers of species, it's the maximum number needed for a particular fleet is used to target what's the target coverage for that fleet. In this case, rather than use that highest number in that particular fleet, you would use the next highest number, the penultimate, to determine coverage for that fleet. That drops the number of days you need, and then you'd repeat this again and again until you've reached within the funding constraints. This is sort of a graphic representation to try to show what I'm talking about. This is the Mid-Atlantic Otter Trawl Fleet. It's an example data that was put together for the fleet. I don't think it's truly representative of the year. In this particular case, you'll see that most of the fisheries clumped together, or most of the species clumped together on the left side of the graph. However, the outlier there is actually red crab in this particular fleet. Under the normal system, that would require 5,551 days to reach the 30% CV. However, if you eliminate red crab, that one species cell, you drop down to the next highest, which it's hard to see, but I think might be dogfish. But it saves 5,218 days, or $6.3 million worth of coverage. It does impact red crab. It jumps that CV up to 140% if you're at that lower level of 333 sea days. But it does not then impact other fisheries, other species in that group quite as much. I'm trying to see. Okay. In the run-through that we did for this, of the 46 agency-funded fleets, only three fleets needed to have sea days reduced, and in fact only three cells and resulted with a CV greater than 30%. Again, that was using pooled money across sources, so it's potential there might be some changes in the future. It has a potential for impacting the fewest number of fleets within a species group. It is non-discretionary. It's a formula you have ahead of time. And you could then add some days back if there are discretionary sources of funding. One thing I should mention, because all of the fleets are, there are few things that have outliers like this red crab one. If you are truly, really constricted on funding and you start getting down below the 300 days being available and cutting further, you can see you'd hit a lot more species and they'd start jumping up more. But if you're that restricted in funding, no matter what method we use to determine priority sea days, a lot of cells will start being hit. So they do cluster together, and this is the method to try to lop off some of those larger discrepancies that are able to identify. Getting back where I was. The last one we looked at for this for prioritization is adjusting the filter cut points. As I said, there's a mortality total mortality filter and a total discard filter in the original SBRM. I've gotten ahead of myself. This process tries to iteratively increase the two. The default is a 2% mortality filter and a 5% of the total discard filter to cut those off. If you do this, you can see that you eventually get drops, but it drops very suddenly in some cases. In this case, it drops from 10,883 days being needed to 7,784 days, which is beneath the number that were funded. It does have some weird changes. If you note that line at 16% that goes across, even as you increase the mortality filter, the number of days drops and then increases again and then drops again. So these are things that occur because fleets fall off and become pilot coverage, and so changes the needed amounts to hit the target CV. Of the 46 fleets funded, agency-funded fleets in this, 9 have sea day reductions. 10 cells would result in the sea day greater than 30%. This particular one does not include sea turtles. Currently, the SBRM does not have a use of filters process for sea turtles. It doesn't build on the existing methodology. That's another problem with it. It deviates from the standard 5 and 2% cut points that had been developed. And as I said, non-pilot fleets change to pilot fleet coverage, and that causes some odd results in the filters that come through. And it involves additional analytical work to become a valid approach. In addition to the prioritization process, I want to touch on a couple of other things we've discussed as far as changing things. As far as analytical techniques, the three-year SBRM review found that the unlikely, or it was called the gray cell filter, was not actually necessary. The total discard mortality filter would supersede that unlikely filter, and therefore it didn't seem to be serving any purpose. The FMAT is considering an alternative that would remove that from the process and just save on analytical work developing that. Again, it caused no change in coverage levels. We were also discussed in our meetings of potential revisions to discard estimation methods, but the original SBRM expected a lot of this the changes in estimators to be an iterative process that would be updated as science improves. So some of those revisions have already occurred. Some would occur naturally as they become available, and it wouldn't change alternatives that we're looking at. That's just routine additions that have happened in the estimating process for coverage. Talking about framework adjustments, the original SBRM had a list of things that were frameworkable that could be adjusted in the frameworks or its specs package. That included the 30% CV level, data collection technologies and procedures, the phishing modes, the SBRM reporting requirements, both the annual and the three-year review, and the industry-funded observer programs. Since the 2007 amendment was passed, 17 new phishing modes have been added. As new selective gears are developed, the haddock separator trawl, the rule trawl, these additional selective gears have different discard and bycatch characteristics and should be added to allow more precision in the estimations of bycatch. New alternative in this case would actually keep the same list of frameworkable alternatives, but would actually remove phishing modes. We believe that the phishing modes, which are reflecting gears that are already in use in the fleet, in the fishery, could be added without specific council action, so that they would be added on an annual basis as they're identified, as additional analysis finds that they have a different bycatch rate and should be split out into their own fishing modes, that then there would be consultation or notice to the councils, but the council wouldn't have to act, wouldn't have to have a specifications. It would save time in how these things are incorporated into the process. You wouldn't need another year as a specs package or framework moved through the process to be able to identify and use those. In addition, for annual reporting process, you may recall the annual reports that have been created for SBRM have been upwards of 1,000 pages. It includes a lot of information, just extremely detailed information, and a lot of it strictly on observed discards without estimations of total discards or the precisions of those estimates. This is a process we're currently working on to develop annual reports that would be more helpful to the council in setting decisions. Right now, the center is developing a center reference document for 2012. Using some of these suggestions that came out of the three-year review, that process will be able to use as a, or that report when that comes out will be able to work as a sort of a straw man and working out what elements are necessary or favorable in future reports. So that will be developed into these changes to this annual reporting process to the councils. Last year, at the April meeting, I had a proposed schedule that I talked about that included having alternatives approved at this meeting, a draft amendment in the late summer, approval in late fall, and then having a final rule implemented with the new SBRM by May 1st. Subsequent to that, we've had some discussions with GC, and NEPA, and GC in particular, have suggested additional updating this to a lot of the background information that was in the original SBRM amendment. That information was from 2004. It's not critical to the analysis, but it would be beneficial to update a lot of that information. To do that, we think there's some additional time. The schedule will have to move a little bit because of that. So this is a new sort of proposed schedule we're discussing today. It involves having an update today at the June council meetings. Then we would come back actually with a formal list of alternatives for the August or September meetings. It allows a little more time to develop those and flesh them and describe them a little better for those August-September meetings. There would be a draft amendment to the councils for the November-December meetings. We did not feel that there was enough time between the December Mid-Atlantic Council meeting and what would be the January New England Council meeting to really get public comment incorporated into a final draft, address any issues that come up, and account for the holidays that are in there. So instead of pushing for the final council approvals wouldn't be made until, I believe, April council meetings at this point. They would then move into regular rulemaking, proposed rule likely in June, final rule in September. Although that final rule is September instead of what was April in the previous issue, the practical implication is actually pretty minor. Having the SBRM amendment rule in place by May 1 is already too late to be used for setting coverage levels for the 2013 fishing year. Those start on April 1st, is the observer year. So in effect, although the rule is a few months later, in both cases, the new SBRM process would be used for the 2014 coverage levels set in that spring. And with that update, I will take whatever questions council members have.
Thank you, Doug. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doug, for the presentation. On slide 10, on the filter cut point approach, you indicate that it does not include sea turtles. Do the other approaches all include sea turtles?
Yes, they do. The filter was a special case because the turtles aren't used on the filters aren't used on filters.
And do all the approaches include marine mammals?
I believe they do. Yes, as much as that factors in the SBR.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Jim.
Doug, I was listening to your description of the penultimate approach and the filter cut point adjustment to rationalize the mortality to the money available for trips. And I was just wondering, are those options that are being considered and you haven't decided whether to go with them or they've been rejected? I just wasn't clear on how the FMAT feels about them.
As far as the filter cut point is one that we've developed, but the FNAT isn't really in favor of. We'll put it forward as an alternative, but it does have, we think, too many drawbacks for the benefits you get out of it. The penultimate approach at this point seems to be where the FNAT is leaning, is the most favorable. It does seem to be able to address the most sort of impact with the most saving of money and impact at that end with the least impact on the number of cells that would miss the 30% C fee.
Dave?
I noticed throughout the report here that, you know, it's still dealing mostly with precision. And I remember this as part of some court case somewhere. Is this court mandated that we're dealing with precision? To me, accuracy is more important than precision. You know, we can be very precise, but if we're inaccurate, it really doesn't matter. I would like to see accuracy addressed more and precision addressed less. I'd like some comment on that.
Well, it's my understanding from the SBRM document, and I'm not as up on this as some, accuracy is actually far harder to determine, especially with fish that are essentially visible and move. That precision is the thing that could be measured and anticipated for, and true accuracy is, I'm not sure that there was a means of testing whether or not your bycatch without 100% coverage, you know, every eye on every fish to determine what your accuracy is. And that's why precision was used the first time, and I think that's still the case this time.
Mary Beth?
Yes, just a question on the annual reporting requirements. I think the council has now received at least 2 years, maybe 3 years of reports, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to figure out what the difference is, what we can expect on the report. When we get the report, you really have to go to the Science Center's webpage. I mean, the volume of information is just really tremendous. And I think some of the comments that the council has provided to the agency is, if we could figure out a more workable report that would, it could be more useful. And
yes, that's the hope, is to address some of those questions. They're working with council staff to develop what changes are necessary. When the three-year review went through last year, it developed more useful, I think, tables of actual bycatch extrapolated, or there were some pie charts that were developed, and some of those elements are what they're considering moving into this, trying to get away from the 1,000 pages of endless tables to more useful summaries, and working with council staffs as to what is best for that purpose. So it would bring 1,000 pages down to a few hundred pages, hopefully more useful.
Well, thank you for that, because I think that will make the process easier. And I guess the one just general comment, I'm not sure that we have, you know, any control over it, but the one thing that this does result in is we have less flexibility. So as different issues come before the council, under, you know, the way we have been operating, we can make suggestions to the agency about priorities, and we're not going to be able to do that. And I think everybody needs to understand that. So when we have issues to come up, like, you know, trawl gear in the Mid-Atlantic that is a directed, you know, fishery on scallops, impacting how, you know, you calculate the sub-ACL, and I don't know, you can get down in the weeds pretty quick, but if we can't target a certain fleet for an issue that arises, it becomes problematic, and I'm not sure how, I think that will impact us all in the future, so just keep in mind.
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've already mentioned that last week we went through the process of making recommendations on Amendment 14. And, you know, at the heart of that is the elements related to observer coverage. And we did recommend some industry funding mechanisms. The details of those have yet to be worked out. But one of the points that came up in that discussion was that there needs to be some further clarification as we go forward, that really spells out the relationship between the observer coverage requirements that come out of these amendments, namely Amendment 14 and Amendment 5, and the SBRM allocation of C-days, because the SBRM is a prioritization model, and yet we're taking up these other elements in Amendment 14 and Amendment 5 that relate to observer coverage. So, you know, down the road, there's going to need to be some, I think, clarification of the relationship between what is ultimately a requirement when it's finally approved by the agency in 14 or 5 versus these SBRM allocations. So I just wanted to reiterate that point that was discussed during Amendment 14, but I think that will need to be clarified down the road.
Jim.
Yeah, I would just like to support what Rick Robbins just said, that basically there's no free lunch, and if mandatory coverage is required in a particular FMP to target a particular type of gear or fishery, then when the SBRM allocation does its analysis, depending on whether or not that previous amendment takes precedence over the SBRM, that could take flexibility out of the SBRM allocation. It could take trips out of the pool of possible trips right off the top. So the concern is that there could be competing amendments that are developed, and there needs to be some planning and coordination of that rather than just going forward independently with these amendments.
Anyone else on the council? We have time for an audience comment. Gib, why did I know that you were going to come?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana, marine conservation organization with 245,000 members across the country. So that out of the way, I appreciate the opportunity to talk here. Also appreciate the opportunity to participate at the FMAT meetings. I've been on the calls and at the meetings, and I think that it's a much stronger process, and we understand what's going on, and we hope that there's going to be increased council participation on this. The last time the SBRM went through, it was very much the case that the FMAT came with a product and asked for the council's endorsement without much feedback. And I hope that as we move forward on this, that you as council members look at what kind of information you need to do your jobs coming out of the SBRM process. When you get the annual reports, we're enthusiastic about the improvements and the estimates that are going to be coming every year in the annual reports. They're going to be much more useful, but they're still going to be clouded by the concept of fleets. That we'll get information about large mesh otter trawls that hail in the mid-Atlantic. But we have no idea what fishery that boat is participating in. And if there's a bycatch problem that pops up with one of these fleets, there's really no way to go back and figure out which fishery that boat was participating in, which FMP needs the management attention. And so we hope that as we move forward with this, that there will be some more improvements to the annual reporting and the estimation, the observer allocation protocol to look at the FMPs, the specific fisheries, so that we can apply management action if and when bycatch problems pop up. So that's one of the suggestions, and I hope that the council will get more involved and look at what the end product is. Our other comment is following on what David Gaethel had to say about accuracy. That continues to be the name of the game. When the last SBRM was done, it was done prior to ACLs and AMs being the law of the land. We would now have the mandate in all of these fisheries, and we need to know with accuracy what's being caught in these fisheries and to administer the ACLs and AMs. Without that, we're going to be behind the ball. So we hope that there's going to be some consideration of accuracy whenever these estimates come out, and that those get folded into the monitoring and administration of the ACLs and AMs every year. We really hope that we don't have another SBRM that comes out that won't do the job that you folks need it to do, and we hope that this moves on fairly quickly. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And with that, we've come to the noon hour. We will break for lunch. Those who are doing the farewell luncheon, it's upstairs in the New Hampshire room. We will reconvene at 1:15.